Can modern scientific methods and meditative spiritual theory complement each other? Welcome to Radio Curious. I'm attorney Barry Vogel, host and producer. In the past, it may have seemed that Buddhist beliefs in reincarnation, dharma, and karma might not entertain scientific topics like neuroscience or evolution. But a new project endorsed by the Dalai Lama is doing just that. The Emory Tibet Science Initiative, launched in February 2006 at Emory University in Atlanta, Georgia, is a historic initiative with the goal to develop and implement a comprehensive science education curriculum for Tibetan monastics and allow the scientists at Emory University to learn from the Tibetan monastics. Dr. Preetha Ram, our guest in this edition of Radio Curious, is the co-director of the Emory Tibet Science Initiative. In our conversation, we discuss how Buddhist monks respond to the modern science curriculum, how the program came to be, and how Emory University science professors have responded to working with the monks whose separate personal backgrounds are so vastly different. We spoke with Dr. Preetha Ram from her home in Atlanta, Georgia, on July 27, 2009, and began by asking how she enables Buddhists to understand the latest scientific discoveries as suggested by His Holiness the 14th Dalai Lama. Dr. Preetha Ram, welcome to Radio Curious. I'm interested in the project of which you are the director, the Emory Tibet Science Initiative, and particularly what His Holiness the 14th Dalai Lama said in 1987 about the importance for Buddhists to understand the latest scientific findings concerning the nature of mind and the relationship between mind and brain, whether consciousness does or does not exist itself as a discrete entity, and your role as a science professor in transmitting this information.
We really believe that this is a partnership of two worlds, and the way we at Emory approach this is about learning from the Buddhist monastics as much as sharing with them some of these ideas of science. In fact, we've had two workshops, this year being the second of two workshops, and every time I send 5 or 10 science faculty, they come back marveling at all the new things they've learned and the new perspectives that they now have on their scientific research. So even though His Holiness did say that it was important for the Buddhists monastics to learn modern science, he always, and we echo that, always goes on to say it's just as important for Western science to learn from the practitioners of Buddhism. He calls that Buddhist science, and I would really agree with that term.
I would be interested in knowing what the new perspectives are that you have learned, but before we get there, can you describe what scientific information has been shared in this project with the Buddhist monastics?
It's a 5-year curriculum at the very least, and when His Holiness came to us about 2 years ago, or his representatives from the Library of Tibetan Works and Archives, talked to us about setting up a science curriculum for monastics, it was a daunting task. How do you decide which topics to teach and how much, and how do you know where to start and when to stop? We wrestled with all these questions for about a year, and we're still dealing with all of them. Our approach has been to try to focus on 3 specific areas that His Holiness has said would be of greatest interest to him and the monastics. And one is clearly neuroscience and cognitive science, as you alluded. But the second one is cosmology, and Buddhist monastics and Tibetan history has a long practice of cosmology, and they have a well-developed theory of cosmology. And the third, of course, is health and health sciences and sort of biology. So we've decided to focus on these three, and then we sort of drilled down and said, of these large subjects, it would take, you know, years to transmit all that information or share all that information. What are the specific topics that would be most relevant and most pertinent to the monastics? And to answer that question, we've had monastics, we've consulted people who have a really thorough understanding of both domains of knowledge.
And what answers have you come up with?
What we've come with is a small subset of neuroscience, a small subset of cosmology. I'll give you an example of cosmology. We are starting, for example, with the origins of the world. So we start with 13th, 14th century ideas, and then we are taking that step by step to our modern 20th century ideas of how the world began and what is the world composed of. We also have been talking about fundamental principles of physics. You know, every school child here knows about the laws of physics and Newtonian physics, but we will take that all the way through to quantum physics and the concepts therein. So the real challenge is not so much sharing this information with them, but quite often trying to answer the kinds of questions that the monastics come back. And those are one of the things that we really cherish, because as scientists and teachers, we've all been teaching for a long time, but in the Western context, so the students that come to us have had many years of high school physics and then some years in college, and so their questions are very different.
Well, how about in the situation of Darwin's approach to evolution? What are some of the responses you have received from the monastics?
Buddhist philosophy has its own system of evolution, and it's not hierarchical like the Darwinian method. So a monkey or an ape, it has the same status as a human being. In these and in other sorts of issues, when we've come up with this, we find the monastics ask us to explain, keep pressing us, and have wonderful arguments drawn from their philosophy to refute it. And then after a certain point, they look at us and say, well, that's really interesting. But of course, we all know about reincarnation. And so we say, well, how do we know about reincarnation? And they just look at us and say, well, His Holiness is a reincarnation, and for them, that's the end of that argument. So it's been very interesting to see where they'll take up an argument and where, for them, it's a given fact almost. And so we're very careful and respectful of these boundaries, and we enjoy the kinds of arguments they come up with, and we try to engage with them at these levels.
Perhaps we can move on to the neuroscience aspects and the information that is being taught in the Emory Tibet Science Initiative.
So the neuroscience is, for us, we have a different view of what the brain is. And I've been told that the Buddhist view of things, the brain is sort of there like an air conditioner. That's sort of the closest way they could explain it to us. Its function, where we see the brain as having a central role, in fact, most important role in managing all the functions of the body, for them, it's just another organ. And so when we launch into the history, and we sort of approach this in a historical manner, here are the experiments that lead us to believe that the brain is a seat of function, of emotion, and this is why we think from these kinds of experiments and observations, when you have people that have injuries here, this is how they behave. We show them videos. We put that in front of them. It's very difficult. It's not easy for them to align their beliefs with what we're presenting them. And we've even gone so far as having dissections. You know, we have sheep and sheep brains, and we've taken that there. And it's amazing to me that they're really very open to all this, and they're eager to learn, and yet there is a point beyond which you can't convince them of these facts, that to us are facts. And so what our faculty have been doing is they go back and they say, okay, now what's the basis, and what is your basis of your philosophy, and why do you think this is the way it is? And so it's been that sort of the areas of exploration or joint exploration that our faculty have indulged in.
Checking or comparing their given assumptions with the scientific assumptions.
That's correct. With what we consider in our modern science, you know, our assumptions or our beliefs. In Western science, you have the scientific approach. You have observations, you have data, and that leads to hypotheses, which are either validated or thrown away. And one of the things we try to do is to sort of explain to them, this is why we believe what we believe in, and here's the logic. And logic is something that they are really good at. It's the foundation of their knowledge system. And so when you set it out and you sort of lay out the principles of logic, and here's how it goes from observation to conclusion, they understand it and they're able to see it at that level. But I think deep down, it's very difficult for them to accept that. And so they sort of, it's almost like they're humoring us. You know, they're saying, yes, that's great. We could see how you would believe that. Thank you for explaining it. Now we know why you say the things you do. But of course, we all know that it's something else. So it's been a very interesting experience.
So if we take that away from Darwinian evolution and apply it to, let's say, Newton's laws of gravity, how do they deal with that?
The physics actually is a lot easier for them to sort of understand, because I think they have a better innate conceptual sense for physics, you know, objects falling. Newtonian physics was easy. They're able to understand and apply physics. The stretch for them is when we get into the universe, the beginnings of the universe.
Something that's more difficult to see.
Yeah, it's something more difficult to see, and something that they have a very strong belief system in, which is, you know, which to them is very logical, it's unarguable, and it's something that they spend a tremendous amount of time in debates. So a part of the training, the monastic training, involves debates. So you take a position and someone else will be asked to debate with you on that. And so questions like, how did the earth begin, or how many levels of heaven are there? And these are the kinds of questions they debate with one another on a regular basis. So when we come to the classroom and we say, this is the earth, there's a universe that's made up of many star systems, and it all began with the Big Bang, at one level, they love it, because they're now in their comfort zone, and they're now engaging with us on the very same sort of a debate that they've been trained in. I should mention that the monastics we are teaching have been through at least 8 years of monastic training, so they're fairly advanced, and they're on their way to getting the equivalent of a doctorate. So these are very successful. They're very successful in what they've been trained in. And so physics classroom is where there's a lot of really hot debates, and I can't say we win too many of them. You know, they'll keep pushing us on the origins of the earth and the quantum theory.
In this edition of Radio Curious, we're visiting with Dr. Preetha Ram, a professor of chemistry at Emory University and the director of the Emory Tibet Science Initiative. This is Radio Curious, and I'm Barry Vogel. Well, Dr. Preetha Ram, the Dalai Lama sees a benefit to the world at large for the Tibetan monastics to have a better understanding of the Western science, as we've been characterizing it, and utilized or interpreted by the monastics. Can you help us see where that is going and where it may have been since this program began?
He laid that out very beautifully and very clearly in many of the conversations he's had with us, both at Emory and at Dharamsala when we visited him. And there's, I think, two, three ways of looking at what he has set out for us. On the one hand, he's always said that Western science focused on the material world. There's experiments, there's observables, and there's measurements, and then there's conclusions. On the other hand, there's much that cannot be measured or identified in these in the kinds of measurements, and we're coming up against those kinds of things. On the other hand, the Buddhist traditions have looked at things like emotions, and which are not as easily quantifiable or measurable as you can measure mass and distance and things like that. So his point is that when you bring these two very different systems of thought together, especially where you come up where you're in the area of the mind and emotions and behavior, psychology and neuroscience, when these two systems of thought are able to connect, then he believes that a new knowledge, a new understanding that will result from these connections will be able to solve the kind of problems that the Western scientists are up against, you know, trying to understand things like behavior and emotions.
Has there been new learning or new resolution of problems that have come from the project?
Geshe Lobsang, for example, is trained in the Buddhist monastic tradition. The Geshe means he's been through this and he's received the title. At some point in his quest for knowledge, he wanted to learn a little more about Western ways of thinking about emotions, and so he's been at Emory now for a long time, and he's working with Dr. Charles Raison, who is a psychiatrist in the School of Medicine, and together they've done serious scientific investigations involving clinical trials and all that on the effect of meditation. So the one that I'm familiar with, they've taken freshman standard, you know, regular freshmen, and some of the freshmen are trained in meditation techniques. These are not religious, they're just meditation techniques, and there's a control set that is not trained in meditation. The next step is once they've received a semester's worth of training in meditation, you try to investigate the effect of stressors on these two groups, and you look not only at their responses in stressful situations, but because of Dr. Raison's association, you can also look at biochemical markers of stress. And this work has been recently published, and they very clearly prove that the group that has been trained in meditation were able to resist stressors and react in a much better way to stressful conditions than the group that hasn't been trained in meditation. So I think that's an example of good, high-quality Western science working with Buddhist science to give us a kind of an insight that we never had before. So things like that we expect to see a lot more of. And from where I am, I think what's retarded these kinds of conversations and the creation of this kind of knowledge has been a lack of communication. When Western scientists are out there talking to the monastic, you have to remember that for many of them, all these concepts that we talk about and we take for granted are extremely alien. It's really like talking in a different language. And knowing about, and so what we're doing in our project is building in the translators so that more and more people like Geshe Lobsang will understand what we're talking, and we'll be able to understand their conceptual world and their paradigms of thinking, so that we build these bridges. And once we have these bridges built, there'll be many more monastics who, like Geshe Lobsang, will be able to work with Western scientists. And I think there'll be an explosion of new knowledge. So that's sort of, at another level, what we're hoping will happen.
Well, Dr. Preetha Ram, in your professional training, holding a doctorate in biophysical chemistry, I'm interested in what this experience has brought to you on a personal level. You've told us some on a slightly more abstract or on an academic level, but how about personally? What have you learned and been able to apply in your life?
As a scientist, and I've been trained as a scientist for many years, you sort of adopt a way of thinking that I've outlined a little before. It's very fact-based, driven by experiments and data. And I think there comes a time when, and this whole experience has taught me that you have to stop, not only think about what the material world is telling you, but also the whole world that is not defined by hard facts and material data, which is the emotional and the spiritual world. The example that I give you is when we were talking to His Holiness, I had my children with me, and I have three children, and they're wonderful children that go through wonderful schools here in Atlanta. And he looked at me in particular, and he said, the Western world does a great job in educating your children in math and science, but what about their emotional strength? He says, seems to me that the children of the Western world are emotionally frail, and you neglect giving them the kind of emotional and spiritual education that they're going to need to deal with stresses of life as they grow up. And he says, don't get me wrong, your Western education is excellent in every other respect, and you have wonderful scientists and architects and engineers, but are your children going to be strong, both spiritually strong and morally strong and courageous people? And how do schools address this? And he says, your schools don't do as good a job as they could. And I think I would have to agree with him. And so after that, I think more deeply about this. And for us, actually, a very good outcome of this has been the work that Charles and Lobsang Negi are doing with the schools around Atlanta, where they're bringing their meditation techniques to children who are emotionally fragile.
I understand that you have a son who will be entering Emory University this fall, and I wonder if you have been able to use this aspect of what you were just describing in relationship with your son.
Of course, because my son has been a part of many of our journeys to meet His Holiness, I hope he has been affected in a way, and I hope he's learned some of this. In our conversations with our children, and especially my son, who's now going to be a freshman, we place a lot of importance on spiritual strength and moral courage and sort of our belief system. And I'm hoping that as he goes to college and he sort of embarks on his life, these are things that he will remember and that will emerge one of these days as he grows into adulthood.
Well, Dr. Preetha Ram, director of the Emory Tibet Science Initiative through Emory University in Atlanta, Georgia, I want to thank you for being with us on Radio Curious and ask you our two signature questions, the first of which I think you have addressed throughout our conversation, but that's, can you tell us of an interesting idea or concept that either you live by or have learned recently, not necessarily related to what we've been talking about?
I think a lot about education, and I think about it not only because I'm an educator, but also because I have children. And a lot of people ask me about my opinions because I was educated in a very different system, and I'm now educating young minds in the American system. And quite often, what they ask me about can be summarized in content versus, I guess, creativity. And there are people who would believe that 3 years of a young person's life after high school is best spent learning a lot of content so that they get depth of knowledge in a field. I believe very strongly that, on the other hand, what young people should be doing is not only learning content, because that is important, but also learning the skills of the mind and learning to be good people and learning the habits of creativity and problem solving and sort of learning how to talk to other people and sort of communicate. Because I believe at the end of the day, you can always learn more content if you're a smart person. Almost all these kids are in college nowadays. You can always learn more chemistry and learn more math.
But it's the skills that you are stimulating.
And so for this reason, I believe that our American college systems do a wonderful job transforming. There's a magic there that transforms these minds from where they were, where they are now when they're entering college, to when they graduate and you see confident, well-spoken, and creative individuals who will solve problems we haven't even thought of right now. So that's something that I've been thinking about a lot lately.
And finally, can you tell us of an interesting book that you've read lately?
Again, I think the one that I hope you've read this or will get a chance to read, is His Holiness's book called The Universe in an Atom. And in that, he sets out some of his journeys into science, you know, where he started tinkering with his watch and his car. And so he lays out a lot of his philosophy, his approach to science, and he explains why he believes science the way he does, even though he is a religious leader. So I think that's the book that I find fascinating, and that's how I got started on this project when I read that book and I saw how there is no conflict between religion and science if you look at it from his perspective.
Well, Dr. Preetha Ram, I want to thank you very much for being with us on Radio Curious.
Thanks, Barry.
Dr. Preetha Ram is the co-director of the Emory Tibet Science Initiative, based at Emory University in Atlanta, Georgia. We spoke with Dr. Ram from her home in Atlanta, Georgia, on July 27, 2009. The book that she recommends is The Universe in an Atom, by the exiled leader of Tibetan Buddhism, the 14th Dalai Lama. Copies of this and other editions of Radio Curious can be found on our website, www.radiocurious.org. They're also available in CD format. To get a copy, visit our website for further details. At Radio Curious, we appreciate your thoughts and ideas about our programming and enjoy hearing from you. Our address is Post Office Box 7, Ukiah, that's UKIAH, California, 95482. Our email address is curious@radiocurious.org. And the phone is 707-462-6541. You've been listening to Radio Curious. I'm Barry Vogel. Thank you for joining us.